Welcome to the Digital Deal podcast, the series where we talk about how new technologies reshape our democracies and how artists and critical thinkers can help us make sense of these changes. We're recording this episode at the Ars Electronica Festival 2023 in our beloved location Post City, so at times you'll hear trains in the background. My name is Anna Karabella, and for the first part of this episode, I'm joined by Kasia Szymielinski and Ndapeo Onyoti. Kasia is the co-founder of the Data Nutrition Project, an initiative that builds tools to mitigate bias in artificial intelligence, and a fellow at Stanford University focused on building responsible data systems. Ndapeo is an independent researcher and community builder, part of Masakane, a grassroots organization whose mission is to strengthen and spur NLP research in African languages, for Africans, by Africans. In our last episode, we talked about how machine learning and artificial intelligence as technologies coming out of a particular political and economic system perpetuate a logic of extraction, accumulation, appropriation, but also give rise to new forms of these practices. In this episode, we talk about how machine learning and artificial intelligence integrate hegemonic discourse and existing biases, and what's more, amplify them. And we talk to some of the people out there who are fighting back. Kasia? And Pella, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me. I just wanted to start from the very basics, the problems with the data sets that we're feeding algorithms. Let's try to frame that for our listeners.
Well, first, thanks for having us. It's really nice to be able to meet in person. Still feels special. So the problems with the data sets.
Where do you begin?
It's such a real question. I think it makes sense maybe to talk a little bit about the ecosystem of data that we have, because there are different problems based on different parts of the ecosystem. I think that we are living in an age, we're going to look back pretty soon, I hope, and say that was crazy. And I'm so glad that it's changed. But we're currently still living in it, where there's just data everywhere. And the ability to access data is pretty universal. If you have certain skill sets, you're from certain parts of the world, you speak certain languages, there's a lot of data out there. And there's a lot more kind of every day. So there's a lot of found data. There are a lot of ways to create data sets. You can scrape the web. You can build little robots that go out and capture everything, in quotes, that's on the web. Again, this is very specific as to what parts of the internet and even just the internet itself, who's able to contribute to that as a repository of information. And then there is a lot of data that you can buy on people. And those are collected by corporations mostly, aggregated and then sold. So you have lots of different problems across this. I mean, there are issues about who's actually represented in this data and who's not there. We have massive issues around digital divides globally. So who's there and who's not is kind of a basic question. Then you have access to that, who has the money and the ability to get that data. The fact that a lot of the data is being bought and sold means it doesn't really belong to the people that it's about. It really belongs to the corporations, and then that data is used to do things, quote unquote, for us or on us that have to do with marketing and advertising and, you know, statistical analysis. And all this means that if you are building systems on data, which is what most of our applications, our software, AI, if you're building applications on that data, the quality of those applications will never be better than the quality of the data. So all those problems are just going to get perpetuated and propagated through all the systems that are built on that data.
Totally agree. I mean, I come from the global south. We don't have data that represents us. We don't have data in which apps can work for us in the ways that they should. Apps do not have the significant impact that they should. And even creating the data and not collecting it because it does not exist in the quality that we want, because of our history and being a young population, young continent with a young population, there's that need to still create data rather than collect it. That becomes a struggle because you're looking at the costs of going out to capture these data sets, create these data sets, communicate with the knowledge holders, but also embody these data sets should be a reflection of the society of who we are, and looking at how we have developed, there's an appreciation, an appropriateness to culture, to the society, to our norms, to who we are in urban settings. the worry is also that the knowledge holders are severely threatened, some nearly extinct, and that is very worrying in what our future would look like. So it's not a situation of adopt, adapt, and it'll work, because we've seen that, and the reality is very, very, very scary.
So we spoke about working with the data that's already out there, or having to go out and collecting the data. And this very much speaks to our last episode where we spoke about the appropriation of data and how that's just being grabbed, as it drew this parallel between the land grabs and the data grabs. I was thinking there's, again, in terms of having to collect the data and manufacture this data, there's again an imbalance there where you, as you were saying, coming from the global south, you're being forced to actually manufacture this data, which is costly. Whereas we have the big tech that just took it and making it so much more difficult to break that pattern of grabbing and collecting data and using it for your own profits and purposes. What I would like to talk about now, so we talked about the collection side of things, and then comes the pre-processing side of things, where we use words like cleaning the data, which sort of alludes to this need to make order into something that's messy. And that's something that needs to be done to make these algorithms more inclusive and improve the way they see and make sense of the world. And then we have the part of them identifying patterns within the data. I'd like us to unpack the two processes and sort of see how they affect the very notion of truth and how they affect the production of knowledge.
I want to start with the appropriation of data. If you asked me 3 months ago, I would have agreed with you that big tech just take whatever it is that they find. And in these last 3 months, I realized that small tech within our communities would do the very same thing if our data was online. And the problem is, and I'm so glad we're at Ars Electronica, I saw this booth with empathy, community, unity. These are qualities we no longer embody. And we see that in young startups, people from a certain culture community wanting to become the next big tech in their country. They don't embody these values, you know, of where they come from, either forgotten. And if our data was online, I have no doubt that many of them would do the same. And that is worrying. But fortunately, it's not online, and they still hope to like rectify that, where we're able to remind them of what it is to be human and do it right and do it better. So coming back to, yeah, cleaning data and pre-processing, we really worry about this stage. I think for many of us, we follow this design thinking concept or systems thinking concept, which starts with empathy, and that becomes the source of our intent. And as we go out to then create these data sets, we're limiting the pre-processing because that process becomes so natural. We have this quality data set we can be, because we, through empathy, we're called to think, we're challenged to think, we're challenged to unlearn and relearn certain things. And when we then create these data sets, or, you know, capture the narratives of all stakeholders, we're minimizing the pre-processing stage, we're minimizing so many other things and ensuring that there's integrity, ethics, empathy as part of that. And we see that in large corporations, because either they're not investing in the communities to shape these technologies, they're not learning from the past that has harmed so many societies. It's sort of colonialism 2.0, you know, just forced extraction. And I'm not sure how we get back there. but
it's really good. Yeah, so many things you said. I feel like this notion of more data is better, that's even being challenged right now in some of the scientific literature with the large language models, where that has honestly been the biggest shift. It's not necessarily a mathematical one. it's really about how much data they can shove into these models when they train them. And at the same time, they're starting to realize that more is not necessarily better. Actually, higher quality data is more important. And so we're seeing a shift away from just putting lots of random data in and, you know, towards something that looks more like a blended model where they're also feeding it higher quality information that's been looked at, that's been labeled, that's been categorized and annotated by people in the Global South, actually. Mm-hmm. So there's a very real labor component to data extraction, where it's extracted from communities, and then the same communities are given very little value back to work on categorizing and adapting that for use in technology. And I think you're totally right. This colonialism 2.0, it's absolutely the way it has been and the way it continues to be. You know, when I think about the tension as well between openness and rights, there's also a notion of openness is good. Open science is the best way to do it. Open source is the best way to release something. And I think that in the West, we have to get a little bit smarter about that and critical about what it means to just release things or what it means to grab things that have been released. Mm-hmm. Because there's a trade-off. If you put the data out there and someone uses it and they aren't using it in a way that aligns with the original intention, if you gather a bunch of data that's personally identifiable or identifiable within a community or even just makes certain knowledge that was community or locally specific now available for anyone to use, that's inappropriate, right? And so there is a real trade-off between openness and then respecting people's rights. Mm-hmm. And there's just a whole bunch of mechanisms that we don't yet have around guardrails for the use, the generation and the use of data. I run a project that believes this, that we should be collecting data after determining why we want to collect the data. Yeah. And so there needs to be, I mean, you use the word intent, there needs to be some kind of intent that drives the collection of the data. The haphazard collection of things, the scraping and just the, you know, it's not that, I'm not saying that there's never a case where you would want to or have to do that. But generally speaking, having an intention before you do something is probably, we should probably do that. Mm. And then kind of on the other side, when you're using the data, there should be uses that the data was intended to be used for. And then there should be kind of off-label usage, right? Which maybe is not sanctioned and that is irresponsible. And we need big tech and small tech. Mm. And I agree with you. Small tech is even less regulated and flying under the radar because yeah. they're not in the public view. We need all of those folks to then actually abide by the usage restrictions or agreements as they exist. And that just doesn't exist either. So you know, we have all of these tensions and these trade-offs around the processing, the cleaning of the data, and then the usage of that. And we have no mechanisms or cultural mechanisms mm-hmm. to actually use the data responsibly.
There's obviously people like you that do this type of work, but what would you need for your work to become more visible and be inscribed into these practices? Is regulation a solution? And then what sort of regulation, how would that look like? Because I think that's the question that a lot of people have. You know, when you say regulation, it can sound really scary. Obviously, big tech makes it sound really scary, but there are perhaps also traps there, or what other type of support you need?
We have a number of stakeholders that should be involved. And what we've seen traditionally is government, which represents the people, often coming up with these policies. But we see that they're only at the top. And what we've seen is that a top-down approach has often failed. And that is why we have grassroots communities addressing the problem and really advancing language technologies, data sets, and building these technologies from ground up. When we apply that same approach, communities creating data sets that are relevant to them, either for documentation or to be used for revitalization, or to be used to power a particular service that they truly need, then they should be leading discussions on regulation. And they should be part of these steering committees. So it's a good thing that we have traditional councils, and then we have various union councils, and then we have government, and then we have civil society. So when we start at that very level with a traditional council, and then when we move into more application use, then like identify farm boundaries, predict weather patterns, so you inform local farmers. And this is still to make informed decisions that are still aligned in, you know, their traditional ways of living to keep their norms alive. So what we see, the problem with regulation and where regulations do not serve the society but benefit large corporations with money, is that the custodians of data are not part of the discussion. They're eliminated. Their voices, their opinions, their concerns, their values are not protected. They're exposed. Different stakeholders need to be part of the conversation when we talk about regulation. Because if you have an intent on why this data needs to be generated, there are people who agree and there are communities who know, you know, the benefits of this data creation, the end result use case in the ways that it will benefit them. But often they're often eliminated from regulation.
Yeah, I agree that with all of that. I think maybe I can talk about two examples to kind of illustrate some of what you were saying, because I completely agree. The first example isn't necessarily about data, but I think highlights that people, when consulted, have opinions about their own data and have very strong opinions about what they want to have happen. It's often just a problem of education in terms of, not even education, like it's their fault, but transparency into what's happening, right? So not even a way to be educated about it because we don't know what's happening. So one example of that is Apple introduced this privacy label on every phone or device. When you downloaded an app, it suddenly started asking people, do you want to allow this app to track you? And it's really the first time that a lot of people realized that when you download an app, you're giving them permission to track you, to track your device. But that device is probably on you, so, or on some people that share your device with you. So it's now tracking wherever that device goes, which is a good proxy for tracking where you go. And something like 80% of people said, no, I do not want them to track me. It's such a strong indication that when people are given a choice and they understand what's happening, they don't want to be tracked. They don't want that data to be collected on them. So I think that to me highlights the importance of giving people information in a way that is consumable and then giving people meaningful choices. You know, in this case, you could still download the app. You just tell them not to track you. Prior to that, if you knew that you were going to be tracked and you didn't want them to, the only thing you could do is not download the app. That's not an actual choice, right? If you need that app for something, if your work requires that you download something, you have to do it anyway. So that's one example, I think, about how people should be informed. They should be part of the process and they have opinions about their own data. Another example is kind of the analogy that started the organization that I run, which is around nutrition labels for data sets. But when you look at food, right, and in the US and many other countries, we have this fact label on the back of all food packages. It allows you to make a decision about what food you want to buy and put in your body. And the example I use there is when I now walk into a bakery, a local bakery, and there's a bunch of really delicious looking cakes. I love a cake. They have not printed out a label and put it on a cake, right? I mean, they don't do that because the cake is in the window and they made it there. But I'm thinking about the nutritional value of the cake. And that to me is a combination of the top-down regulation, where all the foods that are packaged and sold must have this standardized information, and culture change. And I think we need the same thing. Now, regulation isn't going to fix everything, but those companies are not going to tell you what's in their food unless they have to. The same thing, that companies are not going to tell you what's in their data unless they have to. Will that solve everything? No. But what it will do is help people start to get their minds around what they should know and what they should be asking about a data set. Just like Hannah, unfortunately, I'm thinking about the nutritional content of the cake. And when I encounter the cake, I think, okay, what's actually in this? Is this good for me? I'll know to ask if I have allergies, whether it contains these ingredients, so on and so forth. So those are two examples maybe to support all the things that my colleague here said that I agree with.
It sort of ties in, or already addressed, my next question about like citizenship and political representation and whether we can have any sort of agency within this. Can we refuse to be tracked, to be then analyzed? Can we refuse to become data, basically, and be part of data sets? Do we have any sort of agency?
So there's data in creation, there's data in processing, there's data in storage. So you can go through this entire step of, yes, we've created it ethically, we've created it with the community, where are we going to store it? Okay, do we understand the T's and C's that come with where we choose to store? Will it still be our data, or do they have the right to make use of it however they wish? So then you come to storage, and then it is accessibility, open source to who? Yes, it was probably funded by government or an NGO, and it needs to be archived somewhere, and it's open source to anyone for academic purposes or, you know, whatnot. And then, but then open source to who? And this is where the intent comes in. If your intent is not aligned to the reason we created the data sets or how it should benefit the custodians of data, then no, it does not apply to you.
Yeah, I would add to that too. There's, in many places, I mean, my context is the US, our rights framework is very individual based. And so all of our rights come from the individual. So if you have a problem, you can sue somebody, very litigious. And you as a person can prove that there was a harm that was caused to you personally, and then you can try to seek recourse in some way. And we don't have a great way of understanding collective rights. And I think that, you know, the government is supposed to work in the public interest. Which public? Which part of the public? Sure. Right? And so we do have that as kind of a way to come down on organizations, companies, you know, technologies that are causing harm to a community. But our rights framework is not actually that strong, at least in the US, around what to do if you believe that a technology is systemically or systematically disadvantaging or harming a community. You actually have to find, and I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is you have to find individual cases of harm to prove that there was harm against a group, as opposed to being able to say before the fact that there are harms that are going to be, that, you know, there are risks, let's say, or acting on behalf of a group at large. It has to be through individual cases. And so that's really tough in an era of data, because you're talking about harms that happen at a collective level, or decisions that are made at a collective level. That's one thing that I think is really challenging. But to your question about agency, there's also intentionally messing with the system, right? I mean, you can intentionally create noise. You can create data that's really crappy data that throws people off, right? You can also intentionally be absent or somehow evade data collection. Or perhaps if you're part of an identity group or a community that is not easily categorized. Yes, there's a sadness and a real issue with not existing in the data, but there's also sometimes a beauty in that, because then you're out of the system, right? So I think there is some agency in that direction as well, which is either messing up the system a little bit by injecting noise and reducing the signal, or reducing the signal by not being there.
In terms of the beauty of the uncertainty and the chaos and the incomputable life that one can have, and what can come out of trying to compute everything, trying to compute life in general, and the implications of that for society, politics, and the future in general. What kind of futures can we build on past data and patterns that may be past patterns, but they might also just be made up patterns in the data, or illusions of patterns in the data? And where does that leave us in imagining a way out?
Unfortunately, a lot of these systems are optimized for profit, and so they will go where the money is. And so that's a little bit challenging. So it kind of depends on what the systems are optimized for and what patterns they're looking for. But sure, I think that there are erroneous, quote unquote, patterns that show up all the time. That really is, you know, a classic example is when Amazon tried to build that hiring algorithm, and they fed it all of the historical resumes, and the pattern was that women weren't hired. And so the result was that the, you know, algorithm said, don't hire women. And is that, it's not erroneous in the sense that in the past women weren't hired, but it's erroneous in the sense that you should never hire women, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think that obviously it will pick up on patterns, whether or not they're accurate, I don't even know what the right word is, unbiased, mm-hmm. accurate, true. It's going to, whatever's in the data is seen as the ground truth, right? Is seen as the truth, regardless of whether it's socially accurate or representative or appropriate.
Or even desirable in the future. Because as you say, that might be the case now, and it might have been the case in the past, but that's not to say that that should be the case from here on.
I'm trying to think of three scenarios. One, I'm trying to imagine a veteran or a war hero or a freedom fighter, as we would call them, narrate their 20 years liberating a country and how they survived. Oh, what were they fighting for? How did they live? Were their methods sustainable in like living? Historical data, you know, narratives has, it's thriving, you know, because it has learned from past patterns. And then, so this has not been optimized for profit, but it has been optimized for sustainability. And then another example is post. Another example is treasured communities, you know, who've lived, you know, centuries, you know, as they have, like hunter-gatherers or, you know, nomads. And their traditional ways of tracking and living is what is shaping sustainability efforts in the world.
Yeah, but that's a very good point, that past data can mean different things in different contexts. And to end on a more positive note, maybe we can talk about the work that you two do. And I think it's really important that you're coming at it from very different angles. Kasia, you're more focused on how data misrepresents certain things in certain communities. And Dapewa, you with Masakane, you're focused on how communities are underrepresented and actively collecting data. So it'd be interesting to hear more about that.
So our project is called the Data Nutrition Project. We're about 5 years old, but we became a nonprofit just a year or two ago. And it really was a research project that was sparked by a hypothesis. It was me and some folks sitting around a table, you know, eating lots of cookies and cakes and talking about the problem of AI. So this is like 2018. And it was around that time, a number of other people and organizations were having very similar conversations. We're by far not the only people in the space, just thinking about how everyone is so focused on AI being biased, AI being racist and sexist. And no one was really talking about the fact that the AI was just doing what we trained it to do. And it was trained on data that was unrepresentative or biased in some way. But, you know, those of us sitting around the table is actually a very interdisciplinary group. We had personal experience in building and auditing and using these systems. And so all of us were just kind of scratching our heads and saying, why is no one talking about the data? And at this point, I feel like we and others have done our, you know, we put a lot of work in because people do talk about the data. And so I feel very happy about that. I'm guessing that no one listening to this is going to be surprised about, you know, bias in, bias out, you know, garbage in, garbage out, that kind of a thing. So what we decided that we would try to do, or what we thought would be fun to try, is build a nutrition label like for food, but for data. Simple analogy is that you should know what your machine is about to eat before it eats it. You should understand how it should or should not be eaten, because we also believe that there's no data set that's perfect, and there's no way to eliminate all bias. It's about knowing what the bias is. So we spent a lot of time and worked with others in the space. So there's, you know, data sheets for data sets, there are model cards, system cards, there are fact sheets, there's all kinds of parallel work that has happened in the space for sure. There's even some that are, you know, domain specific, like for language processing in particular. And we borrowed from others and lent to others and came up with a structure of information that we thought was really important. So it goes along the pipeline from intent, collection, pre-processing, and then usage. Although storage is really good, and we should probably add that. So we have all this information that is standardized, what we gather on every data set that wants to build a label. And then we also have worked with some very talented designers to create a standardized visual component that basically makes it very easy to communicate what we learn from asking all those questions. And our hope is that people can glean information immediately if they have 10 seconds, because I know the product manager for almost 20 years, you don't have that much time to choose a data set. 10 seconds or 10 minutes or 10 hours, you're going to find different levels of information. And what we hope this will do is kind of raise the floor so that you can always do more than this, but it raises the floor so that your documentation for data exists. In a lot of cases, it doesn't yet exist or doesn't exist on these data sets that are just out in the world. And on the other hand, isn't like hitting you over the head with a 60-page PDF of documentation, which is amazing. There's so much information, but very hard to consume. And so that's what we do. And, you know, our hope is that we can drive culture change and be part of these top-down conversations too about regulation, about how data should be understood and presented so that people can make meaningful choice.
So at Masakane, we have linguists, we have technologists, we have the first part, which is the data set creation, language experts who are more community and access to the community, linguists who then deal with creating the data model and using, you know, advising on various, the data model documentation, advising on various methods to either to trigger conversation and capture or collect, create the data. And then we have the techies who then come in to optimize, fine tune the models and develop evaluation metrics and. So this is where the participatory approach comes in, that we don't do everything. I always start the day with my parents recording them. And then, yeah, and this is like how design thinking happens. I'm like, okay, so how did you sleep? And I'll find something interesting. It just flows as natural dialogue, but I'm always recording with consent and I have to pay them. Honestly, this is true. This is a true story. I think to date we have over 40 hours just talking to my parents. And that is how it starts. We start talking about a topic. So let's say it's a national holiday or something I saw in the newspaper. It would then flow like that. How do you feel about this? What are your opinions, perspectives? Share. Okay. And then I'd be like, no, but trigger them, you know, to that I'd be on the opposing side. Oh, my grandmother will go off. But that is what I want. Because I don't have, it's very hard for me to find a rich morphology or command of the language anywhere, like in everyday life, because it's all English or some other colonial language. And if I'm interacting with my peers, there's a lot of code switching because we're not learning the language in school and we are far out somewhere in the world or a different part of the country where we don't get to interact with the language as much as we do. And this triggers these methods, you know, stimuli is really to get them to express themselves so profoundly with a rich command of the language. And I really want to be different, to say that communities should be well compensated for creating data. And then we're looking towards things like data conservancies, where if the data is then from a particular community and then it is used by X organization, for the time that this data is powering their model, they should be compensated. The money does not come to me. Yes, Masakane will receive the money on their behalf, like an NGO, have a very small fee to keep it running. But because someone from Masakane was leading this project, there's a data set, X amount, hours, whether it's speech or text, that was used, this money goes back to the community, the language experts who worked on it. And though having the architects of the system present in advising how labor laws should look like then, the challenges in what they look now and how they imagine the future of labor law, these are the directions we go in. Because at the end of the day, the money would come back to them. The end of the day, they're defining how it needs to be used, who needs to use it. The fundamental is really to get all stakeholders involved to agree, build consensus. And this is the same thing I've done with the youth that I've worked with. It's to agree on certain definitions.
There's a very different data that you're getting from just these interactions with your family than the data that you find on the internet and the way people use language on the internet. Yeah. That's very like a specific way, whereas this is a much more in its natural habitat and the way it's being used. Mm-hmm. So I think it'd be quite interesting to compare to see what comes out of this and how is it different. You know, internet has its own language and it's not necessarily how we speak.
Definitely. I mean, the way that we communicate has been shaped by the internet. I mean, the way that I like Google something, I keyword stuff.
Exactly.
It's not a real sentence. You know, I say Lynst traffic app, no Google. And what I'm trying to say is like Google won't index Lynst's transportation. And so I know there's an app, but I forget what it's called. And it's not a real sentence. It's just like words, right?
Yeah.
And normally I speak in sentences. So, you know, we've adapted to the technology. And then if we go back and we scrape from the technology and assume that that's language, I mean, that's just a circular, you know, that's an echo chamber, right? Where we're going to then build technology that communicates in a way that we've adapted to the technology. Oh my God. Right. So, I mean, it sounds like you're building an archive, and yes. I feel like archives are cultural, first and foremost. They're not for monetary gain, and they're not so you can build something on them. It's an archive of culture, right? So that we can learn from our past, so that we can have empathy, so we can engage with people who came before us, right? You know, but first and foremost, you get to like hang out with your grandmother and learn stories, you know?
It's amazing.
So at the end of the podcast, I always ask my guests to send our listeners off with a homework and name an article, a research piece, whatever you can think of, an artwork, an exhibition that you've seen and think people might be interested in. It's sort of connected to what we spoke about today.
I'm getting some looks from across the table, so I guess I'll go first. An artwork that I think is showing this year and also has in previous years, I think it's a continuation of a longer project, is by Lucas La Rochelle. It's called Queering the Map and QT Bot. So I think QT Bot is this year and Queering the Map is an existing project. And so what this is it's a map, it's a web page, and on it you can drop a pin anywhere and just mention something, a memory that's a queer memory of some sort. But importantly, you don't sign in, you don't give your information, no one checks whether it's true or whether the thing happened in the place or whether you chose the place in which it happened. And it's just this collective mapping project of queer memories. And I think it's really beautiful. And then this year's artwork is using that as a data set to generate new memories. So it becomes the foundation on which all of this quote unquote new, but obviously informed, these memories, voices, you know, pictures, all of this kind of show up in this video. And what I love about it is that it really complicates and maybe questions what a data set is and what truth is and how to collect memories and culture without policing it. And so whatever is true for the person is true for the person. We don't know who they are. We don't know how old they are. We don't know what their race is or their gender. And it's just this beautiful kind of human experience. And then using that to generate new information as a way to also protect, I think, the actual memories from being rebroadcast in their entirety. So there's kind of a safety mechanism in there. And there's also just a beautiful dreamy quality of creating from that as a basis additional things that may or may not be true, just like the originals may or may not be true. So I think that's a really beautiful work. And then if people want to go in a different direction and read a research paper, I would recommend that folks take a look at Stochastic Parrots, which is a paper written recently by Bender, Gibru, and Macmillan Major. I think it's fairly accessible, talking about the dangers of some of the AI that is being generated today from an environmental perspective and a social perspective. A lot of things that are still kind of flying under the radar and I think are really important. They're, you know, also just exacerbated issues from previous generations of AI. It's a continuation of some of the risks and the harms. So I think that's also a great paper to check out.
Yeah.
I'll start with art. I liked the piece yesterday by, was it David Shongo?
Yes.
Yeah. The performance. I don't know if he has a name for it, but it was beautiful. It was sound. So picture kids playing in waterfalls and in the well below. And then just like with their hands and like feet playing in the water, you know, splash, splash, splash. Yeah. Splashing. And he brings in various instruments into it. And it's just kids carefree, you know, and I'm not sure if it's Nigeria or Senegal, somewhere in Africa. And that was just beautiful. It reminded me of me, just carefree, hope for a future. You don't worry about, you know, the issues of the now. It's just feeling the music and then imagining. There's a quote I love, which went with it when I saw it. My gift of fantasy has meant more to me than my talent for absorbing positive knowledge. And then a book that I read recently is Braiding Sweetgrass. Have you heard of it? Okay, yeah. Oh, I love this book.
Okay,
it's a researcher from a treasured community who attends school or varsity in the West. And then she comes back. She wants to document things, and she's using these methods, and she realizes that they would not work. And she's just unlearning and relearning so much. And it's just a very, very beautiful book for anyone who's looking to going into, you know, creating quality data sets, working, you know, back to basics, starting conversations with like senior citizens, or just, you know, biocultural values, going back to that and seeing travel differently when we go to distant spaces with so much culture, history, and wisdom, what we can learn. Sustainability talks about how to be more sustainable. The wisdom is just really great and just lovely. So that was uplifting because I read it recently about a month ago, and I've been recommending it to everyone.
Thank you so much, Kasia and Dapela, for being here with me today, and thank you for listening.
The Digital Deal podcast is part of the European Digital Deal, a 3-year project co-founded by Creative Europe. If you want to find out more about the project, check out our website www.ars.electronica.art/EU Digital Deal.